Greetings, and welcome to the Journal of Southern Religion podcast. My name is Art Remillard. I'm the book review editor for the JSR, and I teach at St. Francis University in Loretto, Pennsylvania. In 1787, Bishop John Carroll wrote a letter rebuking a magazine for publishing a letter that he believed was filled with falsehoods and fabrications about Catholicism. He moreover insisted that the new government of the United States had banished intolerance, thereby doing a great justice to all Christians. The bishop then exclaimed, quote, "Freedom and independence, acquired by the united efforts and cemented with the mingled blood of Protestant and Catholic fellow citizens, should be equally enjoyed by all." In 1960, the Jesuit theologian John Courtney Murray recalled the example of Carroll and other colonial Catholics in arguing that the natural law tradition of St. Thomas Aquinas had prepared Catholics for accepting American notions of personal liberty and religious pluralism. My guest today is Mara Jane Farrelly, and she partially agrees with Murray's conclusion. She, too, believes that colonial Maryland can tell us a great deal about the origins of American Catholic identity. However, she stresses that we need to look beyond the theology and into the experiences of Maryland's Catholics to get the fuller story. Professor Farrelly makes this point in her new book, Papist Patriots: The Making of an American Catholic Identity, published by Oxford University Press in 2012. She teaches in the American Studies program at Brandeis University, where she also directs the journalism program. Mara, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, I want to get to your book in a second, but first, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to hear about your unique career path to Brandeis.
When I was in graduate school, I was finishing up my PhD in history, and I started working at Georgia Public Radio. In Atlanta, it took on a life of its own, and so I kind of decided I wanted to do that for a while after I finished my degree. And so I worked as a reporter, a radio reporter, for about 7 years. And then actually a friend saw the posting at Brandeis. It was in the Chronicle of Higher Ed. They were looking for someone who could direct the journalism program for the university, which is this tiny little minor that lives within the Department of American Studies. But they also wanted the person to have a PhD. They wanted the person to have both journalism experience and to have a PhD in either history or American studies or American literature. And so I thought, this is going to be my one shot back to academia. And so I applied.
Well, let me ask you just to follow up on that, because I found your book to be incredibly accessible. And I'm wondering if your experience 7 years at NPR and in journalism influenced how you present your material now as an academic.
It probably did to some extent. One thing I will say about my writing is, you know, when I was a journalist, it's not just that I had to write in a more accessible manner than a typical academic. I had to write in a really accessible manner, because in radio, you don't have the opportunity to go back and reread a sentence if you don't understand it. So when a reporter is reporting in radio, the sentences need to be pretty bare bones, not a lot of flowery, compound, complex sentences. The other thing is the sentences have to be something that the reporter can say easily without running out of breath. And so I do think even when I write an academic book, I have a tendency to read pretty much every sentence out loud to get a feel for it, and that may be reflected.
Okay, well, let's move on to the book. John Courtney Murray has a strong presence in your introduction. Can you tell me about how he became your point of departure for examining American Catholic identity?
There's a question that's at sort of at the core of my research. It's one of the questions that I felt I needed to answer, and that was the question of whether there is any inherent tension between Catholic identity and American identity. Catholic identity being a very communally oriented identity. Let's face it, it is a hierarchical identity. The Catholic Church is many things. A democracy is not one of them. An identity that certainly stresses that there is freedom, but the freedom comes within the community and with the help and the support of the church, as opposed to the American idea, which is very individualistically oriented. Is there any kind of tension between Catholic and American identity? And John Courtney Murray was one of the first people to take this question on. He took it on in the late 1950s and the early 1960s. And the answer he came up with was no, that there is not. Not only is there not tension, but in point of fact, the Catholic mindset is very complementary with the American mindset, because he argues that the only reason the American mindset works is that it's checked by a universe of discourse that is grounded in natural law, which, of course, Catholics are very familiar with. So Murray takes on the question, is there tension between American and Catholic identity? His answer is no. Historians who came after him took on that question, and they looked primarily at history rather than theology, and they looked at the immigrant church, primarily in the 19th and the 20th centuries. And the answer they came up with was, yes, there is tension. There's quite a bit of tension. Now, it did resolve itself, and it's a very fun, interesting story in terms of how it resolved itself. But there is undeniably some tension between the communal mindset of a Catholic and the individualistic mindset of an American. And I think there's a lot of truth to what those historians have argued about the tension between American and Catholic identity. And yet, when I was looking at the historical record for the colonial and revolutionary period, I was finding that in some way John Courtney Murray was correct, that at least in the late 17th century, Catholics were quite supportive of the basic tenets of the American Revolution and the cornerstones of American cultural identity. So how is it then that they were able to reconcile their identities as Catholics with their identities as Americans? I didn't think that John Courtney Murray was right, that the answer lay with natural law. I think the historians who came after him are and were correct to say Catholicism is not naturally complementary of American identity. And yet the historical record showed me that Catholics were quite supportive of the tenets of American identity. And so I wanted to find out what is the reason? Are there other reasons, reasons that have nothing to do with natural law?
Well, and you kind of start this examination by doing this transatlantic quest, going back to England and examining the Catholicism of England. So what were the things happening there that were influencing Catholicism in British colonial America?
That's the community that, you know, the first Catholics in British colonial America came out of, was the English Catholic community. And, you know, I think nowadays when people tend to think of the history of Catholicism in America, I think most people tend to think of it as an Irish story. And the Irish were sort of late into the game as far as American Catholic history is concerned. The first Catholics in what became the United States of America were English. They were not poor. They were actually quite wealthy. They were some of the wealthiest people in England at the time, largely because they were the only people who could afford to pay the recusancy fines that were levied against anyone who did not attend Anglican church services. So they were wealthy. They also tended to be educated. Interestingly enough, many of them were educated at Oxbridge schools because quite a few of them had actually started their lives as Protestants. It became trendy during the reign of Charles I, for gentry to convert to Catholicism. Charles I's wife was a Catholic, and in her court, she preferred to have members of her own faith. And so it's not like there were massive conversions of the gentry during the reign of Charles I, but it did. It became trendy. And so you had a lot of people who were educated at Protestant schools who became Catholics.
And George Calvert was one of these sort of famous converts, and that name obviously is very much associated with Maryland. Can you tell me about George Calvert and the Calverts that come after that and their influence?
Yeah, so George, he began life as a Catholic. He was raised in Yorkshire, which was a bit of a stronghold of Catholicism during the 17th century. He converted to the Church of England when he was around 12 or 13 years old because that was the only way he could have any sort of political career. He was educated at Oxford. He went on and he had a very rewarding political career. He ended up becoming a principal secretary to King James I. And then around 1624, he decided that it was time to leave public life. And so he resigned from office. And shortly before he announced his resignation officially, he privately converted back to Catholicism, which leads some people to think that perhaps he had been a bit of a crypto-Catholic all along. Unfortunately, the historical record does not tell us. But what is clear is that once he was no longer interested in having any public life, he went back to the faith that he was born into. Not only that, but his sons converted as well. That would include his oldest son, Cecil, who took his conversion so seriously that when he converted to Catholicism in his mid-20s, he changed his name to Cecilius, since it sounded more Roman. And then his younger brother, Leonard, converted to Catholicism. Leonard ended up being the first governor of Maryland. And then another younger brother, George, also converted to Catholicism. George, unfortunately, met an untimely death. He immigrated to Maryland, and it's not clear if he was bitten by a mosquito or what. He suffered from the seasoning process, and he actually died shortly after arriving in Maryland. But George was not actually the one who received the charter for Maryland. He is the one who applied for the charter, and he was preparing to receive the charter, and then he died rather unexpectedly, and so the charter went to his son Cecilius. Cecilius was the second Lord Baltimore, but he was the first proprietor of Maryland. Cecilius served as the proprietor of Maryland for the rest of his life. He unfortunately never actually got to visit Maryland. He said to a number of friends on a number of occasions that he fervently hoped to be able to move there with his family someday, but financial considerations required him to stay in England. And also, he was constantly defending the colony of Maryland against allegations that it was somehow traitorous because it was run by a Catholic proprietor. And so dealing with those allegations tended to keep him in England.
So this brings us, since we're mentioning Cecilius, the 1649 Act concerning religion. You indicate that this is more than just making Maryland a haven for Catholics. That was certainly part of this, but there was more going on. Could you talk about that some?
Cecilius Calvert was not a William Penn. He was not a Roger Williams. He did not write extensively about his religious desires for the colony or about the need for religious freedom. And that's because he did not have the freedom to do that. He was a Catholic. At the time that he was looking to populate the colony, people in Virginia were making allegations to the court back home that what he was secretly doing was planning to populate the colony with Spanish priests and nuns who would invade Virginia. So it would have been dangerous for him as a Catholic to be trying to make a formal case for religious liberty. We therefore can't look at something specific that will give us an idea of what his actual motivations are. All we can do is we can look at the historical circumstances and try to extrapolate from there. And the historical circumstances were as follows. Maryland was not a Catholic colony in that it never had a Catholic majority. It never could have a Catholic majority. There simply were not enough Catholics in England to make Maryland a Catholic colony that was also going to be a profitable colony. And we have to remember that that's another key part of why Calvert had this colony. It was a proprietary colony. It was a money-making endeavor. So as a money-making endeavor, Calvert knew that he was going to have to allow Protestants to live in the colony, and he wanted Protestants to live there. He wanted as many people as possible to live there so that he could start making money off of the situation. Initially, he thought that all he would have to do to make sure it was also a colony where Catholics were able to practice their faith freely, all he would have to do is simply not have an established church in the colony. And so from 1630 to 1649, that pretty much is his recipe for how to have religious freedom, is to simply not have an established church. That unfortunately does not work very well because there were a number of Protestants living in the colony who were quite unhappy about the fact that their proprietor was Catholic, their governor was Catholic, some of the key members of the governor's assembly were Catholic, a disproportionate share of the legislative assembly was Catholic. Catholics were practicing their faith freely. They were engaging in all of their hocus pocus quite publicly. And so these Protestants did rise up in 1648, and they temporarily took control of the government. Worse than that, they wreaked havoc on the colony. They burned libraries, they burned fields, and the estimate is that during this rebellion, which is called the Ingle-Claiborne Rebellion, estimates are that 80% of the people who had settled in Maryland were either killed or they fled the colony as a consequence of the Ingle-Claiborne Rebellion. And so when things settled down and Calvert had gotten control of the colony again, he desperately needed to repopulate it. One of the tactics that he used to repopulate it was a tactic that ended up blowing up in his face, but he got in touch with some Calvinists who were living in Virginia who had already survived the seasoning process, so they were quite healthy, but they were not happy living in Virginia because Virginia did have an established church, and it was the Church of England. And he invited them to resettle in Maryland. The climate was similar, be not that difficult a transition for them to make, and he would be able to easily get the colony populated again. to entice them to come up, he pushed what is known as the Act Concerning Religion through Maryland's Assembly. And that act guarantees religious freedom to all Christians. It very specifically says you're not even allowed to call people names for their religious beliefs. And so he lists a number of names that were derogatory terms that were used for Calvinists as a way, again, of enticing these Calvinists to come up from Virginia. And then he also lists a number of names that were used against Catholics because, again, he is a Catholic and he wants to make sure Catholics are able to practice their faith freely. So the Act Concerning Religion restrains government. It says government will not require anybody to practice a particular faith, nor will it penalize anyone for practicing a particular faith. But then the Act Concerning Religion also places an obligation on the people themselves.
So Catholics kind of get a hold of things for a little bit, then 1692 comes. Tell us what happens there and then what the consequence is for Catholics in Maryland.
Well, basically what happened is the Glorious Revolution in England spilled over into North America. The Glorious Revolution was about the Protestant majority of England saying, essentially, we don't care that James II has years of tradition behind his position as the king. We do not want to be led by a Catholic, and we're not going to tolerate it. And so they rose up and they ousted James II, and they did the same thing to Calverts in Maryland. The Protestant majority of Maryland decided that it didn't matter that Charles Calvert had inherited his status as proprietor from his father, who had been holding that status since 1634. It doesn't matter. You're Catholic. We do not want to be under your auspices anymore. And so a group of Protestants came together. They called themselves the Protestant Associators. They rebelled and they set fire to places. They took hostages among some of the Catholic leaders in Maryland. And basically, they were using the psychological ammunition of the Glorious Revolution to justify their cause. And sure enough, they got the backing of King William for their revolution. King William revoked the charter from the Calvert family. Charles Calvert, who was the third Lord Baltimore, he was the last Catholic Lord Baltimore. He lost the charter. The charter was not restored to the Calvert family until many years later when it was Charles's grandson converted back to the Church of England. And so the Calvert family does regain the charter, but they regain it as an Anglican family, not as a Catholic family. Immediately, a bunch of different laws are passed. Catholics are no longer allowed to hold office. They are no longer allowed to vote. They are no longer allowed to worship publicly. In fact, there was quite literally a lock placed on the chapel door in St. Mary's City to keep them from worshiping publicly. A few years later, the church was actually torn down and its bricks were used for salvage. And actually, from what I understand, in St. Mary's City right now in Maryland, there is an effort to rebuild that church, to try and build it as it was before.
You have a really interesting analysis of religious practices during this period and what its ultimate function ended up being in terms of preparing Catholics in a way for independence. Can you talk some about that?
What ended up happening as a consequence of the rebellion of the Protestant Associators is that the laity and the clergy in Maryland really came together in a way that they had not been together before. Back when the colony was under the auspices of a Catholic proprietor and when Catholicism was officially tolerated in the colony, there were some priests, they were all Jesuits, there were some priests, English-speaking priests, who came over to Maryland with the expectation that they would be able to have the kind of relationship with the local government that their colleagues had with the local governments in predominantly Catholic countries like Spain and France, that they would be able to enjoy privileges that the clergy enjoyed in countries like Spain and France, and that they would enjoy a great deal of support from the state. And Cecilius Calvert, and also to some extent his son Charles Calvert, made it very clear to the priests that this was not going to be the case. You have to pay the same taxes that everybody else pays. You have to go to assembly meetings that everybody else has to go to. Everybody in Maryland was, all freemen in Maryland were required to show up for certain assembly meetings. And the priests didn't want to go to these meetings. And the reason they didn't want to go is that it was a pain in the neck to get to them. You know, you had to travel miles on end through woods that didn't have highways and that sort of thing. And so the priests would constantly try to get out of their service. And Calvert said, no, you're just like every other person living in Maryland. You're not special just because you're a priest. And so there was a certain degree of tension between the laity and the priests during the Catholic period of Maryland's history. But after Protestant Associators Rebellion, the priests and the laity quickly come together and they realize we're going to have to cooperate with one another if this faith is going to survive in this colony. And not only are we going to have to cooperate, but we're going to have to make some accommodations. We're going to have to be willing to tolerate some things in each other that we might not have been willing to tolerate if we were back in the old world. The priests, for instance, very quickly learned that they simply could not expect Catholics to marry only Catholics. It just demographically, it was not possible in Maryland for that to be the case. And so they were going to have to make an accommodation to the laity so that the laity could actually marry outside of the faith. And they do that. The priests actually perform marriage ceremonies for Catholics who are marrying Anglicans, for Catholics who are marrying Protestants. They realized that life in the New World was quite different from life in the Old World. In the Old World, you had fields that had been cleared of trees for sometimes literally hundreds of years, and that is not the case in Maryland. You have to get rid of all the trees before you can plant the fields, and you need to do it as quickly as possible because otherwise your family is going to starve. And so holy days when you're not supposed to be doing any work at all don't go over very well with the laity. And the laity care enough about their obligations to petition the priests for a dispensation. So it's not like it's unimportant to them, but they do petition the priests to accommodate this reality of life in the New World, and the priests show themselves willing to do it.
How does slavery start to fit into the story of Catholicism in Maryland at this point?
Well, you know, that's actually something that I only address a little bit in the book, but I do address it a little bit more extensively in a paper that I had published in a journal after the book came out. I always thought I would throw this out as an epilogue in the book, and then I didn't have enough room in the book, and so that's why I turned it into another paper. Catholics were not like their Protestant neighbors in Maryland, in that Catholics were comfortable from the get-go with the idea of bringing Christianity into the slave quarters. Protestants do not start to become comfortable with this idea until we get into the 19th century, whereas, you know, 17th century, 18th century, Maryland's Catholics are ensuring that their slaves are baptized. They are entering into spiritual partnerships with black Catholics so that, you know, sometimes you'll have a white godfather and a black godmother to a white Catholic child. I did actually find one instance, it was only one instance, but one instance where a white slave owner chose two of his black Catholic slaves to serve as grandparents to his white child, Rachel. So they're entering into spiritual partnerships with blacks so that they can ensure everybody is Christianized. They are having priests perform marriage ceremonies for their slaves. I mean, marriage was civilly illegal for slaves in Maryland at this point in time, but marriage, of course, is a sacrament for Catholics, and so these Catholic slaveholders are making sure that their slaves are married within the church. They're even black Catholics and white Catholics are being buried in the same cemeteries in Maryland at this point in time. And basically, I guess what I'm saying is there was nothing in the Catholic worldview that suggested that simply because these people became Christians, that simply because they became Catholics, that it then became immoral to hold them in bondage. Catholicism was perfectly okay with that in a way that Protestantism wasn't at first. Protestants were reluctant to Christianize their slaves, largely because they worried that if they converted their slaves, that it would somehow be immoral to then continue to hold them in bondage.
So the differences between Protestants and Catholics starting to become part of the rhetoric of the revolution, as you note. And so you have all of this revolution speak mixed with anti-Catholicism, yet at the same time, as you note, the papists are becoming patriots. Talk to me about that very complex formula.
I guess the whole book is kind of an answer as to how these papists were able to join ranks with the patriots in spite of all of the nasty anti-Catholic rhetoric. I think one thing that's a little bit simple to talk about has to do with what I call memory, that during the 18th century, which is referred to as the penal period in Maryland's Catholic history, this is the period after the Protestant Associators' Rebellion, when Catholicism is essentially outlawed in the colony, and yet Catholics continue to live there. This period lasts from 1692 all the way up until 1776. And during this period, it was decidedly inconvenient to be Catholic. There were many, many reasons to convert to the Anglican Church, and yet Catholics did not. They held on to their Catholic identity. And so this raises the question of how did they do that? And I think memory played a role. What do I mean by that? Catholics in Maryland were rather unique among English-speaking Catholics or Catholics in the English-speaking world. In England, Catholics throughout this entire period were not allowed to practice their faith freely. In Pennsylvania, which was a colony that had some Catholics living in it, most of them were sort of spillovers from the Maryland border. And by the way, I'm not entirely convinced that some of the Catholics who are said to have been living in Pennsylvania were not actually living in Maryland, because you also have to remember that up until 1776, it was a really contested boundary between Pennsylvania and Maryland. But nevertheless, there were Catholics living in Pennsylvania, and those Catholics had pretty much the opposite experience of the Catholics in England, in that Catholics in Pennsylvania were always tolerated, at least legally. Culturally, maybe not so much, but legally, they always enjoyed toleration. So England Catholics were never tolerated. Pennsylvania, they were always tolerated, at least legally. Well, Maryland, it was a hybrid of those two situations. Maryland's Catholics had been tolerated. Not only had they been tolerated, but they were actually in control of the game throughout most of the 17th century. And then throughout most of the 18th century, they were not tolerated. So in other words, these people knew what it was to have toleration and then to lose it. And one of the ways the 18th century community sustained its sense of Catholic identity was to construct a cultural memory, a collective cultural memory of what life had been like in Maryland for their Catholic ancestors before the Protestant Associators' Rebellion. And this constructed memory was not entirely accurate, but that's okay. It didn't need to be. It was not supposed to be a factual rendering of the past. It was supposed to be a mechanism for helping these people to sustain their Catholic identity. It helped them sustain their Catholic identity by providing some sort of noble origin story to what it was to be Catholic in Maryland. So one of the components of that memory that became very important to this community was the idea that Maryland had religious toleration in the 17th century because of a law that had been passed by Maryland's local assemblymen. It was a local law passed by local lawmakers. It was not a parliamentary law passed by people in parliament. In other words, Maryland in the 17th century had had the freedom to do something legally that could not be done in England. And that the reason Maryland's lawmakers had the freedom to do this in the 17th century is that Maryland essentially had its own constitution. It was a constitution that was very much indebted to England's constitution. It certainly resembled England's constitution, but it was a separate constitution that was slightly different. And one of the things that made it different is that it was a constitution that allowed for religious toleration. All right, so this becomes a big component of the constructed memory that sustains Catholics throughout the 18th century. Maryland has its own constitution. Not only do they use this idea to sustain a sense of Catholic identity among themselves, but they also use it to fight efforts throughout the 18th century to actually apply anti-Catholic parliamentary laws to life in Maryland. At a number of different points throughout the 18th century, local lawmakers in Maryland do attempt to void out all of their local anti-Catholic legislation and simply say, we're gonna use the laws of Parliament instead. Parliament has some anti-Catholic laws, and so we'll simply apply those laws to Maryland. And Catholics rise up against this, and in a roundabout way, they say if you're going to do that, you have to pass your own anti-Catholic laws. You can't simply apply Parliament's anti-Catholic laws to life in England, because if you do, you're violating Maryland's separate constitution. I mean, Catholics are arguing separate constitution as early as 1718. Well, of course, this notion that there is a separate constitution for each colony becomes pretty important to Protestant colonists in the 1760s in the wake of the Stamp Act. And so I suspect that when the Sons of Liberty start making the separate constitutions argument, this was an argument that Catholics heard, and they found it to be quite familiar to them because it was an argument that had really been sustaining them and also had been affording them some degree of protection throughout most of the 18th century.
I want to just finish this off by going back to an article you wrote for the Journal of Southern Religion, our most recent one, on Catholics in the Early South. So with that in mind and with your book in mind, what do you want to tell scholars of the South to pay attention to with what you've offered?
Well, to pay attention to the fact that their region is really where the Catholic story in America began. I think that's probably pretty important, that when we think of Southern history, Southern religious history, we tend to think of it as a Protestant story, as an evangelical story, even more specifically. And I guess I would like Catholic scholars to recognize that although they have pretty much have always been a minority, even to this day, it's not like the South is crawling with Catholics. One of the things that was interesting for me when I moved to Georgia was I moved from a city, New York, that had two archdioceses within the city itself. And then I moved to Georgia and there were only two archdioceses in the entire state of Georgia. So I know that they're not a majority and never have been a majority in the South. But nevertheless, there is a solid and interesting Catholic story in the South. And so I would like historians of Southern religion to recognize that that story is there. I think I would probably like to see historians of colonial Catholic history also to recognize that the story of colonial Catholicism is more than simply a French story or a Spanish story, that there is an English story as well. It is a really important English story as far as the American founding is concerned, and that story, of course, is Southern as well. And it is Southern. I mean, when you get into the 19th century, there is a little bit of debate about how Southern Maryland really is, right? But that debate's not there in the 17th and the 18th century. That is a solidly Southern colony. The Chesapeake was actually home to the second largest slave population in the British Empire in the 18th century. So I guess that would be my answer to your question.
Very good. Well, with that, we will conclude this podcast. Again, the book is Papist Patriots, The Making of an American Catholic Identity. Be sure to check out Professor Farrelly's article in the Journal of Southern Religion at jsr.fsu.edu. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.